Okay. Today again is August 31st, 2007. This is an interview for the Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation Oral History Project. I am Brian Purnell, and now speaking with Mr. Benjamin Glasgow. Mr. Glasgow, if we could just start for the record, if you could just spell your first and last name and say your date of birth.
Benjamin, B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N, A, Alexander, Glasgow, G-L-A-S-C-O-E, 37.
Okay.
Date of birth.
And where did you grow up as a child?
In Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. I was born at St. Mary's Hospital and resided on Herkimer Street and Howard Avenue, 1034 Herkimer, at the time of my birth.
So you were born in 1937. Most of your memories as a child would be probably from the mid to late 40s and the 50s. Mm-hmm. What was Bedford-Stuyvesant like as a community during that time?
Well, again, I went to PS 28, which is, again, on Herkimer Street and Howard Avenue. A lot of small families, a lot of families. That's what I remember. I remember peering through the fence. We lived in a top floor apartment, and the owner of the house was Jewish and lived on the first two floors. And we lived on the second two floors. So I guess I'm telling you I'm remembering a somewhat integrated neighborhood. It wasn't totally black, but a lot of black families. However, mixed in were Irish, German, and Jewish families in private houses. When we moved, I moved to Sterling Place. And Sterling Place was even more integrated. Sterling Place near Albany Avenue, that was a large number of Italian and Irish families and some black families mixed in. And that was on Sterling Place between Troy and Albany Avenues. And we stayed there right through my high school years, from the sixth grade through high school. That's where we lived.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Tilden High School.
And so that would be, I guess, in early 1950s.
Yes, I graduated from high school in 1954.
Was that also a racially and ethnically integrated place?
It was predominantly white. Mm. There were about 10 black students in all of Tilden out of about 4,000.
Mm. After you graduated from high
school... In my class.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's early 50s. After you graduated from high school, what did you do?
I took a couple of city tests, and I went to Hunter College in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm. And eventually you went to Shaw University?
Eventually. I jumped from school to school, transferred, went to night school, worked part-time, and 7 years after I entered college, I graduated from Shaw University.
In 1961.
That's right.
And then you came back to New York City.
For a short period of time.
When did you eventually move back and settle in Brooklyn?
Well, I guess I went to California. I got married and stayed with my wife until she finished college, which was, came back in 63. So I went away for 2 years when I graduated college.
So 1963.
Yes.
And where did you live at that time?
We moved to my parents' house on Sterling Place, where I had lived as a child.
Okay. So 1963, you're back living in Sterling Place after moving around quite a bit in the late 50s. But mm-hmm. How did the neighborhood compare or contrast to what you remembered in the mid-40s and 50s?
When I moved back, Bedford-Stuyvesant was at that time almost totally black. Most of the white people had moved away. So it was a predominantly black neighborhood, but still the part I lived in was predominantly homes. I never lived in public housing. There was public housing nearby, but the neighborhoods I remember was made up of all families and children.
Were there particular political or social conditions that you noticed that were different from the late 40s and 50s to the early 60s?
No.
Okay. How did you come to get involved in community work, or better yet, in doing some research, the Central Brooklyn Coordinating Council, right, seemed to have been very important in what became Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation. Were you aware of that group in the mid-60s?
Not particularly, no. I had been involved in amateur sports. I was involved in community through the baseball and football teams that moved throughout the community. So I was involved in community, but through community athletics.
Were you an athlete as well as a teenager and a young man?
I ended up playing football at Shaw University and baseball.
Oh. What position in baseball?
I pitched, played first base, then the outfield.
A little bit of everything?
A little bit of everything.
And were you offense or defense with football?
Football, I was a running back.
Oh, okay.
So
you became involved in local community sports organizations.
Yes.
In Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that? Who was organizing them? Where? What did you do?
Well, one of the groups, there was a league called the Ice Cream League, and they played out of Prospect Park. And I'd just get on a bus and go down, and I'd sign up with a team. I didn't have a real mentor other than there was a local man who formed a team. His name was Greshchuk, John Greshchuk. I'll never forget him. Very nice man. He had a son who played. And we had about 16 fellows, all from the neighborhood, totally integrated. Formed a baseball team, and some of us went from door to door and raised money to buy the uniforms.
This was in the 60s?
Yeah.
Huh.
No,
this was earlier when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But this was in the 50s.
Oh, okay.
Went door to door and organized and formed a baseball team, and somehow, through parents, got enough money to join a league and played baseball at Prospect Park. That was my early existence.
In the Ice Cream League. So when you came back in 63, did you continue doing
the... Just played baseball with a local team called the Seals, the Brooklyn Seals and the Brooklyn Bisons.
Where did those two teams play?
All the games were in Prospect Park. There were a series of permits you would get from the Parks Department, and most of the leagues in Brooklyn congregated in Prospect Park. So I had an opportunity to play against people like Joe Torre, who was the manager, is now the manager.
Right.
Fred Wilpon is now the owner of the Mets. He played. A lot of people who were high in the community played as youngsters in Prospect Park.
The Seals and the Bisons, the two teams you played with in the 60s, were those Bedford-Stuyvesant-based
mm-hmm.
teams?
All base teams, totally black teams.
So they were okay. What type of work were you doing at that time? What was your 9-to-5 job, so to speak?
My 9-to-5 job, when I came back, I had taken a test for the Department of Social Services. And for several years, I was a caseworker for the New York City Social Services Administration. I was into taking civil service tests. So I took a state test, and I became a wage hour investigator for the State Department of Labor. And I stayed on that job for 4 years. And I investigated the payment of wages, paying the minimum wage. I enforced the minimum wage law for 4 years for the state of New York. And most of my cases were, again, all in Brooklyn. I was assigned to Brooklyn. For 1 year, I worked as a wage hour investigator based on my experience with the state for the federal government. And while I was working for the federal government in 1968, I think I was making about $7,000 a year. And I heard about a job opening of a new company, new corporation that was going to do community work. And since I'd been involved in the community through the athletic programs, it appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the job paid $10,000, which for me was a huge sum at that time, because I was making $7,000 and change with the federal government. And the football team I played with, one of the coaches was a man named Ray Jennings. And his brother, Everett Jennings, was an employee for Bed-Stuy Restoration. And Everett gave me an interview and passed me on to another man who was running community programs, and he hired me. That man's name was Booker Gaither. His brother was a legendary football coach at Florida A&M University. And I guess they knew I played ball. I was fairly personable. They hired me as a community organizer in 1968 at Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corp. And I, again, that was the beginning of my career here.
What type of work did you do as a community organizer that first year that you joined?
There was a plan to open two neighborhood centers, outreach centers. In other words, we would not be a company that just sat in the main office. We would go to go out to the people. And I was hired as a community organizer at one of those two neighborhood centers. Each one had approximately 9 to 10 employees, and we were supposed to do things that would improve sanitation, housing, again, athletic programs for youth, things like that, all that were in this community effort. And a lot of it, since we started it, we had to, you know, think for ourselves and create.
Mm-hmm. If maybe I can back up a little bit, are you familiar at all with the initial beginnings of Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Center, like in terms of who the major players were in the beginning and how it came into existence?
Yeah, I know that Senator Kennedy came, took a tour, and there was Elsie Richardson and somebody.
But you were not directly involved.
No, I was not one of those. I was hired after it was formed.
Right. One of the things that people talk about in the initial formation is this kind of split, or even this kind of dual nature of the Restoration Corporation and Development and Services Corporation. I've read some things that said Restoration Corporation, which was predominantly of the community, its leadership was predominantly black and they did community work. And then Development and Services was predominantly white and it was the business community. Did you notice when you came on in 1968 any tensions between those two groups or any types of tensions that had to be worked out in those initial years?
No. It was entirely beneficial to the community.
Mm-hmm.
It was a sound, I felt it was a very sound premise that in those days the white guys controlled most of the money, the white people, and you had a bunch of whites or non-blacks who were extremely interested and dedicated. It showed. And none of the black people resented them at all. That was the last problem we had. There was a warmth and a cooperation and a camaraderie that I had never experienced in the workforce before. And the white people were sincere and worked very hard. And I felt it was great. And I had no feelings like that anyway, because my grandfather was Irishman, and I came from a mixed background. You know, I was black, I knew that, but there were whites and American Indians in my family.
Right.
So it was never any problem for me.
Right.
And I didn't seem to be a problem for anybody. All the people here got along well together, and the white people and the black people just worked together.
Right. Could you speak a little bit about your initial impressions of the first leadership cadre? So
Frank
Thomas
and John Doerr.
And John Doerr, or even, you know,
both terrific. Just, you couldn't beat them. Frank was brilliant, and John was very smart and caring. And he kind of played low-key, which was good, because Frank had an aggressive personality. And it worked out very well. I thought very highly of them, and all the people that worked with DNS, which was so-called white group, all the board members, like Spencer and those guys, were super people, and worked very hard to bring money into the community. Bring money to restoration could use. Very necessary. That's why we've been 40 years, because we had a cooperative effort, and people with resources were part of the board that could bring something to the table instead of begging for every penny from the government, which tend to be the failure of most programs. And as the government seemed to plan failure, would have made ours fail if we didn't have the outside resources. Because after certain successes, they took away the funding, Reagan administration.
So let's talk a little bit about 68 to 80, but let's maybe concentrate on the development of these outreach centers. What did they do in the late 60s and early 70s?
Well, we saw a need. One of the things when we were out there, we saw a need to improve sanitation services. So we sent people in, and me and a couple other people sat down with the sanitation department and said, let's improve service. We got an agreement from the city to pick up bulk items. We sent our staff into homes and organized certain days and certain blocks with the sanitation department where they would come and pick up bulk items. So we organized people into drives to get rid of garbage and junk and on a schedule where the sanitation department could pick it up officially, not just throw it on the street. What else did we do? We organized people with housing complaints. We helped them when they weren't articulate. We'd send workers with them to the housing department to try to get their problem solved. We organized summer camps. We sent outreach workers to help kids who couldn't somehow get to summer camp. We organized clothing drives to help them get to summer camp. We organized youth athletic teams, basketball teams, softball teams, baseball teams, and we had tutoring in the centers so that some of the kids could do better in school.
I'm curious.
One other thing was important. Oh. We organized people to use their local health centers.
I'm sorry, Mr. Glasgow. I do just need to about that.
My friend Raul Rodriguez could be of help to you.
All right, so I started the machine again. Okay. So I wanted to ask a question a bit about sanitation, because that does seem to be one of the first community outreach areas that BSRC engaged in. What was the problem with sanitation in Bedford-Stuyvesant in 1968?
No irregular pickups, garbage all over the street, inability to get bulk items picked up. That was a problem.
Well, why? Why wasn't the sanitation?
Who knows? Who knows? No one was holding them responsible. They did what they felt like doing. Maybe, I don't know. I'd have to know why they didn't have better management. Why didn't a man from sanitation, why didn't he go around and check on his men and see that they were doing their work? It was like in some of the poor neighborhoods, if nobody cared, the sanitation groups weren't as diligent. Mm. In the white neighborhoods where people were on the phone every half hour to break chops, it got better service. I don't know. Maybe the noisy wheel gets
the
grease, oil.
Yeah,
grease. And so we became the grease. We became the noise, and we encouraged the sanitation department to perform better. We didn't fight with them, but they saw us as an ally, somebody who could get the people off their back. And we got a lot of cooperation.
Mm. That's fascinating. Were you involved at all in the Superblock programs?
Wendell was the Superblock.
Right, he spoke a lot about that.
Peripherally. Wendell was a member of one of my center staffs.
Right.
So out of my staff, as a community organizer, and I say mine because I eventually became a director, out of that, Wendell was one of the guys who went out and helped organize the Superblock.
Sure. Right.
Since he lived on it, he was perfect to do it.
Right. The director, when you were the director of community programs and then eventually became the manager of the RDC Commercial Center, right? I think in 1972. But you were doing community programs before the Commercial Center.
We expanded to five centers.
So that was
five.
What year did you have five centers going?
I can't remember exactly. Right. I would say we started in 68, maybe by early 72 or late 71, we had five neighborhood centers.
Wow, that's fast.
You rent a storefront, you staff it up, what can I say? And you have a model, don't forget, you had two.
Right, the first two were on, Albany and Ralph?
300 Albany and 144 Ralph.
Any highlights from those five centers, that first, I guess, 4 years of operation? What does anything
highlights
stick out in your mind?
The sanitation drives was extremely successful. Hmm. And the youth athletic programs, the summer camp programs, we got summer camp slots. And when you got something to give people, when you're going around and people have never been off the block, we took kids out of Bed-Stuy who almost had a heart attack when the bus went across the bridge. Also, there was a Christmas party that was sponsored by the Kennedy family, where we got the kids and took them to Rockefeller Center.
Oh, right.
Now, after we built the rink here, that was fine. But those early trips to Rockefeller Center and to hear those kids scream in amazement at going over a bridge, you realize how really deprived they were. You know, me, I grew up, my family took me everywhere, took me on trips to the airport. It was a big deal. We didn't have any money, so one uncle had a car, and we'd go sit at the airport and watch the planes come in. That was a big deal. These kids had never been on a, never seen a bridge. And there were many, you know, events like summer camp programs and the Christmas parties and different activities. And we gave a series of Easter egg hunts in Prospect Park. Well, those were great highlights, events with young people. And I always liked working with young people. But to assist some of these older people to get out of their house for the first time and go to a doctor, you know, helping people down four flights of stairs, things like that. We did a lot of hands-on, person-to-person assistance to elderly, et cetera.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No.
How many people at the height of these five centers, how many people were working in these different community centers?
About 50.
Wow.
We had maybe five times eight, about 40. We had about eight in each center.
Did if looking back now, what would you say either in your life as in Bedford-Stuyvesant or as a student or as an athlete, what would you say prepared you to run this one-of-a-kind, you know, community development program?
Having lived in the community and sincerely cared about people in the community, those were my main qualifications. So I had the experience of knowing the people in the community and the genuine desire to want to help them do better. And if you look at any group of people, I could go to Iraq and look and see what they need. They need safety, education for the children. And I guess I could develop a program to assist them. And that's, I don't mean I'm the only person in the world like that. It's just having an empathy for the community and have some knowledge of that community or have some knowledge of people who have lived maybe some hard times. You can translate that anywhere.
Do you remember any initial struggles during those first years? Any challenges that you felt that you had to overcome to keep things going?
We had a program called the Home Improvement Program.
Right. Now,
did you ever talk to Tom Keller? You're scheduled to talk to Tom Keller. He owns a construction company.
Mr. Rice had mentioned him, so I was going to at the end I was going to ask
Keller
you.
Keller will tell you a lot about that. Just it was a program where we had to make an impact. We came in as a new group. And one of the things we wanted to make an impact on is cleaning up the brownstones, helping them. So we developed two things. We developed a training program where we could take unemployed youth and teach them construction skills, or unemployed adults, for the most part, men and women. And people were not, they used to people coming around home improvement swindles.
Right.
So a lot of resistance, thinking that there were swindlers coming around. Who was going to paint their house and cork the windows and put up scaffolding for $100? They thought you were crazy. A lot of them slammed the door. You had to get one or two starting to work and then show the blocks that it was working on. And the money, it was easy to do for $100 because the money was federal job training money.
Right.
And that was the hook. Now, I didn't think up that. Probably Frank Thomas thought that up.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Keller had a lot to do with it, running it.
Mm-hmm.
And they just we just did a job training, and it just grew and grew and grew.
Was that home improvement, was that part of the, I've seen references to something called the manpower training division?
Yeah, it was all tied together.
That was all part of the division.
Mm-hmm.
But so initially there was some kind of skepticism from people.
Absolutely.
Right.
They wouldn't let you in the house. They wouldn't listen to you.
Right.
Until you got one or two doing it and they saw the results. And you, again, you don't forget, I had people who lived in the community working for me who could go in and relate to these people.
Is it something, now that I'm just thinking, would be good to ask, how did you find your employees? Like, how did you make your hires?
This first group, there was also, at the beginning of Restoration in 1967, there was a training program whereby chronically unemployed people, it was a manpower training program to help people get jobs. Manpower has been around for years. And they put all chronically unemployed, so-called misfits, frankly.
Right.
And Like Wendell, I'm just telling you, was the one of the fittest of the misfits. But they were all people. Like Wendell was a chop breaker. Wendell challenged everything anybody said to him, and that's not the first guy people hire.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
They want to hire a guy to say he has a boss, believe it or not. Wendell wasn't like that. He challenged everything. Bright guy, but he challenged. So he was not easily employable, and he was part of that training program. That training program got about jobs for about 100 people.
Mm.
And they got jobs all over, industry, public entity, private city. The last 20, the 20 that, and I wouldn't even tell him this. I don't know if he knows it yet. The 20 that nobody wanted to hire, there were two convicted murderers who had been paroled, Charlie Murray and I think Glanville Hines, a couple of ex-drug addicts. One of the worst, the most aggravating guys was a guy named Rodney Small, who was brilliant. He's retired as a city fireman now. He went on, he aced every test he ever took, but he never shut his mouth. He never could give you, you couldn't get 5 minutes to, but some of them were the worst, and they thought they were the winners. That was the one of the most interesting parts of filling those neighborhood centers. The last 20 people from the job training program, the 20 least employable, that nobody wanted to hire, became the original staff at the center. And that's true.
Wow.
That's the fact. And I said there were several convicted, you know, murderers who served long time.
So okay,
that's what we had to work with.
Yeah. How did you, you know, how did you supervise the unsupervisable?
Just, I don't know. Just by being regular and being willing to work hard and being willing to go out and show them what you wanted them to do. And don't forget, they went in with a certain pride.
Yeah.
They were going to improve their community. And there were no rules that you had to stamp on their heads and time clocks. So they had a chance at a decent paying job, and they worked.
Mm.
They were good. Some of them were extremely bright. There were guys who were stroke of genius. One guy, ex-drug addict named Glanville Hines, the surliest looking, meanest guy you've ever seen in your life. And he was brilliant. He could get people to do things and make people feel comfortable and figure out how to get around the welfare system. There was another guy named Walter Chin. You ask Wendell about Walter Chin. Did he ever mention Walter Chin? Well, mm-hmm. Walter Chin did 20 years for murder. He was a leader of a gang, and he had gotten out of prison. Now, somebody looking at his resume, just that's why he was unemployable. Brilliant. Drink on the job, get drunk. But even drunk, he was better than 90% of the other people I had. He could go into a welfare office and demand rights for a woman who hadn't gotten benefits for 5 years and get them. He was an absolute genius at securing welfare benefit rights for people. I don't know whether they were afraid of him or he just knew how to figure out the system. But there were some brilliant people that was supposed to be unemployable. And just by being with them day after day, you learned how to work with them.
Mm-hmm. Maybe if we could speak a bit about when you became the manager of the RDC, the commercial center, what did that job entail that was
different?
They
were having trouble here. They had called, they got leasing agents, they got people who were professionals, and nobody wanted to take space here.
Hmm.
And they sent me to Michigan State for a course in shopping center leasing and management. They said, maybe Glasgow, you had success managing the unmanageable. Maybe you could rent the unrentable. That was it. They just sent me to a couple of courses and set about trying to get people to come here.
And what was that process like?
Well, many interesting processes. Got Social Security by using the contact of Senator Ted Kennedy, who marched me into the director of the Social Security Administration's office and said, I want you to put a space in Bed-Stuy. And that wasn't me selling. That was Ted Kennedy telling this guy, I control your budget in the Senate. I want an office in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Hmm.
So we got 5,000 feet office here. Me visiting many businesses that had previously said no and just trying to tell them what a wonderful place Bed-Stuy was and how many potential customers were here. Just using basic intelligence. And the guy who really, my boss, Jim Shipp, he really came up with the idea that got Pathmark in here. Hmm. We took an equity piece with Pathmark, which was a big deal in those days, getting a supermarket like that. And what I thought of was putting, they said there's no parking, we can't do it. In this denser neighborhood, they didn't need parking.
Right.
But we took what was going to be a movie space under the market, and we had an elevator. That was my idea, bring an elevator up and make the market over there. And that worked out. And then the rest was just dogged persuasion, just digging after people, getting in bed with learners, meeting a guy named Dave Greenwald, and meeting the leasing managers and convincing them this was a wonderful place. Going to a telephone company, they said no. So I had a photographer take photos of the people outside the, I knew a local paper, and I had photographer take pictures of the lines of people outside the block on the street. And I said, you mean to tell me you don't need a nicer office to serve these people? And I put in the paper. Now the paper, they didn't know it, the paper was the Daily Challenge, where Tommy Watkins was a friend from the community. And the Daily Challenge had a circulation at that time of about 30. But when I sent those copies of that paper to the telephone company, they came out and looked at space and decided to take it. That's how I embarrassed them off of Nostrand Avenue. Made contacts at Brooklyn Union Gas and Con Edison. Made such good contacts at Con Edison, they eventually hired me away.
Right. What were you involved in the IBM moving that plant?
That was economic development.
That was a separate section.
That was a separate section headed by a guy named George Glee, who's deceased, who was a brilliant guy. There's a retired Con Edison guy who was my roommate in college, who I brought here and then brought to Con Edison with me. His name is Lou Williams. And he knew a lot about economic development from that grassroots level.
Did he work at Restoration Center in economic development?
As long as I did.
He was Williams.
In economic development.
And he's still living?
Yeah. He's just retired from Con Edison, just like I did.
I'll speak with you when we're finished about that. Were you involved at all in bringing the arts to Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation?
I hired Marjorie Moon. I hired Teddy Gunn.
Teddy Gunn. That was the man that I was going to ask about. Who? Can you speak a bit about Ted Gunn and Marjorie Moon and how
Marjorie
that...
Marjorie is still here. She's given her whole life to making that theater work. When there was no money for the theater, she used her family's savings. She's an absolute giant. Besides being a big woman. She's a brilliant, brilliant, dedicated person as you will ever meet in your life. I'll just say that to you.
Sure.
Take the opportunity to meet her.
Sure.
I think she's an absolute goddess because of what I've seen her give to that theater.
Mm-hmm. And Ted Gunn, what was his role?
Abandoned artist. Sentenced to die in a hospital of some type of respiratory disease. And who came out of it, became a great artist, knew the community, and ran many programs for children out of a neighborhood center. He never listened to you, but he did whatever he wanted, but he was brilliant, so you didn't have to sit on him. Just a great artist, and influenced many other young artists, developed a series of art shows and exhibits and galleries, just way ahead of his time. Still alive, got about 15 children, fourth or fifth wife. And who's an absolute griot.
That's how you would describe Ted Gunn. Sounds like someone...
And had griots around him.
So
you
what?
Need 2 hours for him.
I found a quote that... I guess it was with an interview done with you earlier. Let's talk a bit. So it seems like Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation is cruising in the 70s. I mean, it's expanding its commercial relationships. It's bringing businesses into the community. It has five neighborhood centers doing all this type of community outreach. You know, what happens in the 1980s that causes... does something happen that causes a shift? The quote that I was going to share with you, I think, and again, I think this came from another interview you might have done in the 90s, was that there was too much reliance on federal funds. So,
yeah, because they took it away. Reagan stopped the funding. He closed the agency that funded the program. I think it was under Reagan. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The other part was this. We were a victim of our own success. This program was told to us it was going to be self-sufficient. And I believe you got to ask Frank about that. If after 2 or 4 years, what we were doing, we were given a grant, and we had a grant, and we put it in a bank, and we invested it, and we made money off it. And somebody from the federal government decided that wasn't kosher. So all that self-sufficiency was bullshit, and you can quote me on that. All that desire to tell you darkies in the community you're going to be self-sufficient was bullshit, because somebody came along and decided that we shouldn't invest the money. Well, what would any business do? And then they started to dole the money out like Mazda to slave. And that limited the ability we had to grow and make money with the money they gave us. And I think in the second or fourth year, if I know Frank fought it like hell, but they wouldn't give us the money in advance and didn't allow us to make money off the money. Well, then you didn't want us to be self-sufficient from the beginning. It's all a bunch of bullshit. It made many of us angry. I think some people quit because we were hired under false pretenses. That idea that we were going to become a self-sufficient entity was, it charged us all up. But we didn't want to quit. We didn't want to stop. So Frank figured out ways to get donations, more increased donations, and make money off some of the businesses, and kept us going. And then eventually, they eliminated the funding. So we had to go all to grants and different agencies. Yes, it was federal funding, but if we had been allowed to move ahead in the intelligent, aggressive way that the black and white geniuses that were running this place knew how to make money. I mean, you give a $2 million grant, and you give a guy, William Spencer, who's the head of Citibank, or Tom Watson's the head of IBM, they'll take that $500,000 that we don't need for the first 6 months and make $2 million off it. And we would have been flying to the moon. But whoever the powers that be were, they didn't want us to make money off the money. And they held it up, took it back, and started giving it out $100,000 at a time, just as you late for when you needed it. That was a real, that was a rough deal. But again, brilliance of Bed-Stuy Restoration Board and leaders and DNS. And the DNS guys were a bunch of monsters. They were brilliant guys. Spencer's a legend in the banking industry. Tom Watson is a legend at IBM. A guy named Benno Schmidt was an absolute genius. Mm-hmm. These guys knew how to make money and knew how to raise money.
Hmm. You leave in about 81, I think, or 80?
Yeah, I was raising a family. We had a boy in 62, and a girl in 64, and they were getting to college, and there was a, you know, Con Ed came along with a 401k, a pension, great benefits, and I had to go. I got a little emotional because thinking of my son, who was a guy in the World Trade Center.
Right.
Was a firefighter. And just thinking about when he was born. But he left me three beautiful grandsons who I'm going to see now.
Right.
And my son looked a little bit like you. He was a big red guy with sandy hair.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. Well, that's...
I went to Con Ed.
Right.
Because it was the benefits were such right. that it helped me in raising my family. But I quickly came back to the Board of Restoration, and I've been working with Restoration ever since.
You're on the board...
Now.
You've been on the board ever since.
Not the first couple of years I stayed away. But then I came on the board, and that board contacts gave me a good excuse to keep. I can't tell you, I must have helped donate $300,000-$400,000 mm-hmm. in goods and services to Restoration. Mm-hmm. And it was a pleasure.
Hmm. One last question. What do you see as the future for Bed-Stuy Restoration Corporation? So it's been 40 years since It's been around. It had its ups. It had its downs. What do you see the future of Bed-Stuy Restoration Center 40 years from now?
Continue to be a viable part of this community, which it is, and the center and the programs are relevant, more relevant. There are more education programs. It's the cultural programs. I mean, what community wouldn't want a theater like this here? I see it as very relevant, and I see it being brilliantly led by what I call the savior, Colvin Granum. I really feel that we had some leaders who didn't measure up to Frank. But Colvin has been a great leader who had a will. You know, he could make a lot more money as a lawyer, but a will to work in the community. What can I say? And he's brilliant, and he's dedicated, and he's done a fantastic job in bringing us back to almost solvency, because there's always a deficit here. You know, it's just never that statement about always having too much reliance on grants is just is a fact of life. If we could ever develop a revenue stream that wasn't dependent on grants, then he could do more, because there's always work to do. Right. But he's made some wise decisions, like moving away from Pathmark, who were not treating us fairly, getting a large amount out of them, finding a market like Foodtown, who improved the quality and caliber and financial base better than Pathmark would have, though Pathmark certainly served its purpose.
Right.
So, again, with Colvin's leadership and a dedicated core like Wendell and Judith and Doris and some of the people that are still here.
Judith, who is that?
Anglin. She's like a personnel assistant. Extremely dedicated and extremely important to here. Wadia Latif. Mm-hmm. These are giants. I'm just telling you. I know them from the beginning, from the day they came here. Marjorie Moon, Wadia Latif, Judith Anglin. Those are really wonderful people who love this company.
One last question. All this work that you've done, starting in the late 60s, through the 70s, even after you worked for Con Ed on the board here, and your community work elsewhere, how do you, you know, what drives you to keep doing this work?
A lot of pride in what restoration has accomplished. And I think my pride in, you know, Con Ed was good. It was a job, though. I didn't have to. The work I did at restoration sensitized me even more to the community. And so I moved toward community-based programs to try to help. I work at with a school called the Trey Whitfield School, which has come from, which was started by a couple that lost their son in a boating accident and has grown. So education, kids, good causes. The Harlem Group, good causes. Hmm. East Harlem Council of Community Improvement was merged with PROMESA, so I stayed on that board so they wouldn't completely lose their identity. And restoration, just enjoying seeing the work continue and having pride in what I was able to do here and what others have been able to do. Hmm. Friendships, you know. That's all it is.
Excellent. Let me just turn this off.